be the main features of an Islamic authority or government?
Main feature is that they want to practice, as I mentioned, and perform all Islamic laws all over the country. This is an idea of that. They want to have the teachings of Ahlul Bayt practiced. You know, talking about the all aspect of the teachings of Ahlul Bayt with regard to the morality of Ahlul Bayt, ethical issues of Ahlul Bayt, you know, ma'arif of Ahlul Bayt, which means the teachings of Ahlul Bayt. I mean, whatever related to Ahlul Bayt, alayhimu salatu wasalam, the pure progeny of Noble Prophet Muhammad, we want to practice that. For example, if you go to Nahjul Balagha, you find that Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam described the lines and the borders of Islamic government.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
For example, you should take care of the destitute, poor people. Yes. You should practice justice.
That's right.
Okay? And many other qualifications of the just leader. So this is very huge difference between these ideas, which is the Islamic government stemming from the Nahjul Balagha,
yes,
and the orders of Imam Ali, or other, you know, let's say mundane government who are looking for their own interest.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
But the main question now is that some people might say that Islam is a religion for example, 1,400 years ago. How to apply Islamic rulings and laws to a new political secular system in the 21st century? Because in today's world, most of the systems are republicans or are federal or are, I don't know, secular or something like that. They are based on the voting of the people. How to adjust Islamic laws led by a clergyman to the modern world, a modern system of laws?
You know that actually this is one of the accusation against this divine religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They say that the Islamic law and Islamic teachings are actually for the 1,400 mm-hmm. years ago. Actually, this is a great accusation against this divine religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You see that actually teachings of Islam are alive, you know, because whatever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentioned in the verse of Noble Quran in the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, they are alive, they are fresh. And how we prove that they are alive? Because through the process of ijtihad, we understand the whatever we need. For example, we have some issues which is for modern day.
Yes.
Okay. But if you look at the, you know, whatever Ahlul Bayt and whatever we have in the verse of Noble Quran, they are to some extent related to these examples of nowadays examples. And this is could be understood by the process of ijtihad, by the process of independent reasoning.
Yes.
You can find and many reasons and you can compare these concepts, I mean Islamic concept, compare it and confirm it to the examples, contemporary example that we have.
That's
so
right.
By this process, you can easily understand the, you know, this religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is alive and it is related and mentioned whatever human being need for, you know, any generation till the day of judgment.
Yes. And all in all, in the history of Islam, we could see that the clerics had role in at least giving, we can say, counsels or consultations to the kings of their countries. And we can say sometimes they directly ordered and sometimes indirectly the Muslim scholars had role, for example, in shaping or at least, for example, giving authorities to some of the people in the land.
You know that they have some kind of cooperation, for example, supporting the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or by any other, you know, contextual issue that they have, they were living in. They wanted to support and establish, you know, the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But having this Islamic government, actually, although we have the concept of the Islamic government and the Wilayatul Faqih, the, you know, governments of the jurists, qualified jurists, we have it actually in the verses of Noble Quran and in the narrations of Ahlul Bayt. But we do not have similarity in the history, of course, before Islamic Revolution to have this kind of, you know, full authority of the, you know, qualified jurists to have it trying to follow the actually orders of Ahlul Bayt and establish the orders of Ahlul Bayt in the country.
Yes, but what is important is that if a clergyman wants to get into the field of politics, he has to be fully, we can say, informed about the new sciences of the world too. For example, economics, isn't it? Sociology, psychology, something like that. Because in the new world, when you are working with a new system of laws, you need your own expertise. If you are not expert enough, or if you do not have expert consults or counsels around you, on that time you might face some problems in leading a country.
Exactly. You know, for the, I mention and I emphasize unqualified jurists.
Yes.
One of the qualification of jurists is that you, exactly what you mentioned, that jurists should be informed and to be, to some extent, some kind of expertise with regard of different branches of sciences. For example, management, I don't know what you mentioned, different branches of science that are necessary for the leader and actually for the official ones, you know, because in Islamic government we have different officials. For example, judgmental officials, officials to the governmental officials and so on and so forth. All of them, they have to have, to attain this kind of qualification, to be aware of the different scientific issues.
That's right.
Because ignorant person who does not have any expertise cannot do any affairs. But more than that, I believe that what's needed is actually to be the honest one and to be a qualified one and to be God-wary person, God-centered person.
Okay.
Because these are very important. Because if you are most qualified person, but to have some kind, but looking for your own interest, not the interest of the community or the people or nation, in that case, you cannot be beneficial for people. I want to say that when we say qualified person or qualified officials, we mean all different kinds of qualifications, including different sciences, you know, to be God conscious and so on and so forth, to be brave,
that's right,
to be manager,
yes,
to understand the, you know, world, let's say, different, you know, groups in the world.
And schools of thoughts.
Yes. And so on and so forth. Many qualifications for the juries and, of course, different branches of authority in Islamic government to have these kind of capacities.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, for a nice elaboration regarding the interference of clergymen in politics. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li aliyin wa husayn wa hasan. Li aliyin wa husayn wa hasan.
الآن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روبا شابت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction. It has led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises. The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad, such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come. The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increased interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saeed Puriza, London.
An Islamophobia scandal now threatens a British student union following anger over the sacking of its female Muslim president amid allegations of anti-Semitism. Shaima Dilali was elected president of the National Union of Students in March. Dilali was initially hailed for being the first ever black Muslim female to take up the post. However, she was suspended from the role in July amid an investigation into anti-Israel comments she made up to 10 years prior to her election, including a 2012 tweet in which Ms. Dilali wrote, "Khayber Khayber, O Jews, Mohammed's army will return to Gaza," a tweet she has since apologized for. An NUS statement on the decision said,
"Following the independent King's College-led investigation into allegations of anti-Semitism, specifically into the then president-elect under the NUS Code of Conduct, an independent panel has found that significant breaches of NUS's policies have taken place. As per this finding, we have terminated the president's contract."
Dilali expressed further fury at the news of her sacking after she discovered it on Twitter, shared by a pro-Israel newspaper who may have been leaked the story prior to the NUS updating Mrs. Dilali. In response, Dilali has vowed to fight the outcome via a pending legal challenge alleging discriminatory treatment. Mrs. Dilali's sacking has sparked furious anger across the British Muslim community, who believe this is gross censorship of pro-Palestine activism.
Anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism is like comparing apples and oranges. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Jewish faith. Actually, it's the weaponization of the Jewish faith that we are seeing. What we are talking is a colonization enterprise. That is the whole existence of the Israeli regime is a colonization enterprise. It's clear that the whole issue is to criminalize pro-Palestinian sentiment, which actually shows you how effective pro-Palestinian sentiment is.
Things could get very ugly for the NUS as Muslim student bodies are threatening a boycott and Dilali plans her fight back. The NUS has previously prided itself on being an inclusive environment for all and an advocate of free speech. However, they now have to prove that that is indeed the case amid racism and Islamophobia accusations thrown their way by the former president, Robert Carter, London.
The Pentagon has admitted that the United States has soldiers on the ground in the Ukraine and far from their embassy, a decision which drastically increases the chances of accidentally sparking an all-out war with Russia. The troops are allegedly only inspecting and doing a proper accounting of U.S. arms deliveries to Ukraine, but many have alleged that their actual role is to provide weapons training and perhaps more. The United States has already provided nearly $20 billion worth of military equipment to Ukraine this year. Both Republican leaders and some progressive Democrats have openly criticized the costly aid, which has only further escalated the conflict. It has already been widely reported that scores of U.S. ex-military personnel and retired officers are helping to lead the war from inside Ukraine. The Pentagon claims the so-called inspectors will not travel to the front lines, but that gives many little comfort.
I think they're acting very recklessly, and they're dragging us to something that could be completely avoided now that you have, you know, Russia saying, hey, we'll use nukes if you don't back off, right? And I think this isn't a war between, you know, Ukraine and the United States. This isn't a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between NATO using Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia.
Washington has known for months that their weapons shipments went totally untraced once they entered into Ukraine. Not only does that facilitate Defense Department mismanagement and possible corruption, but the arms could wind up in the hands of far-right militias and be used to destabilize the area for years, as NATO weapons did in the Balkans and then Libya. U.S. weapons have already been found to have been illicitly diverted to Sweden, Denmark, and as far away as the Netherlands.
When you have the United States, when you have the Pentagon saying, hey, we're going to post all these long-range missiles on your border, Ukraine, so that you can reach Moscow in 6 minutes, obviously Russia is going to do something about it. So I think the United States foreign policy right now is essentially pouring billions into Ukraine, pouring like billions into mercenaries, pouring billion into this proxy war in order to weaken Russia.
With the U.S. kicked out of Afghanistan, illegally occupying northeastern Syria, and precariously perched in Iraq, many wonder if Washington and NATO have chosen the Ukraine for their new theater of war. Anti-NATO demonstrations across Europe have been violently repressed in recent weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A new report by the Afghan Journalistic Center shows that at least 127 journalists and media workers lost their lives during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Investigations also show that in more than 90% of those cases, the ones responsible for the deaths were not brought to justice. The Association of Afghan Reporters is demanding the International Criminal Court to take a look into the killings. People are also asking the Taliban to stay true to what it has promised and show support towards Afghan journalists. That includes ending impunity for crimes against this group of workers who are constantly under danger in a war-torn country.
The U.S. started the war on Afghanistan and caused devastation and casualties. It should be held accountable for the death of all civilians, especially journalists, in the past 20 years. The International Criminal Court should investigate the killing cases of Afghan journalists and recognize them as international crimes. The families of slain journalists should be paid compensation. Unfortunately, so far, not a single case has been inspected.
This comes as those 127 martyred journalists have been two honest and dedicated staff, Said Farhad Takaddousi and Habibullah Hussainzadeh, who lost their lives on duty in 2011 and 2017. The relatives and colleagues of the two continue to honor their memory.
Two of our colleagues at Press TV were among the victims of U.S. war on Afghanistan. Syed Farhad in 2011 and Habibullah was martyred in 2017, both on duty and in war incidents. They were so close to me and meant a lot for Press TV and the medium community in Afghanistan. Their loss should not be forgotten or ignored. We demand justice and compensation for their families.
The commemoration of martyrs comes as the Afghanistan situation is still tense for journalists. Rights bodies are calling for support and protection by the ruling Taliban and the international community. Due to war and insecurity, Afghanistan has been one of the most dangerous countries for reporters. And there have been journalists like Press TV's martyrs who gave their lives in the line of duty. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Rating agency Moody's has recently changed its ratings outlook on Italy's banking system from stable to negative. Business conditions for Italy's banks are expected to further worsen in the coming 12 to 18 months, especially with regard to the quality of their loans and earnings. The news broke at the heels of a series of downgrades in medium-term growth forecasts by the Bank of Italy, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, Employers Association Confindustria and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
We will hold a highly important cabinet meeting on Friday, during which we will discuss new budgetary targets as the government is racing against time to draft the 2023 budget law.
Italy's statistical agency ISTAT has predicted that the Italian economy will be flat in 2023 after growth of around 3 to 3.5% this year. Moody's forecast was even more cautious, predicting 2.7% growth for this year as a whole and zero growth next year.
The challenges for Italy go well beyond economic growth. Prices have reached record highs lately, with the country's annual inflation rate hitting almost 12% in October and energy costs still out of control. In addition to that, the euro's weakness with respect to the American dollar has significantly eroded the purchasing power of the Italians.
Milk, bread, pasta, all these basic items cost much more now. I'm very worried.
When you go grocery shopping, but also when you buy fuel or are faced with paying exorbitant energy bills, everything seems to be out of control. That said, I am pretty sure that they are not telling us the truth about what's really going on.
On Thursday, Italy's new far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni travelled to Brussels to meet with the leaders of European Union institutions for the first time. In the Belgian capital, Meloni held two meetings with the President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, and EU Commissioner for Economy, Paolo Gentiloni, in which her main ask was reportedly greater joint EU efforts to cope with energy costs. Max Civili, Rome.
An attack on the convoy of ousted Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan wounded him and several of his supporters who were marching towards Islamabad, demanding early elections. Police said that a gunman opened fire at the campaign truck carrying Imran Khan, wounding him slightly. Since his ouster in a parliamentary no-confidence vote in April, Khan has been alleging that his dismissal was a conspiracy engineered by his successor Shahbaz Sharif and the United States. The PTI leadership has directly blamed Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a high-ranking military official for carrying out the assassination attempt.
We demand that these three men should be removed from their posts.
If these people are not removed from their positions, then there will be nationwide protests.
While asking Imran Khan's supporters to stop the blame game, the government has assured every possible support for holding high-profile inquiry into the assassination attempt.
The incident is very unfortunate and condemnable, but it should not be politicized, and speculations on this incident must be avoided.
Political experts believe that the attack on the PTI party chief will trigger further political instability and chaos in the country.
I think in the days to come, the Pakistani political atmosphere will be more charged. It will be more violent. This gun attack on Khan will definitely change Pakistan's political scenario.
The attack on the former Pakistani premier also sparked countrywide protest and international condemnations.
The attack on the former Pakistani prime minister has further fueled the ongoing political tensions. It is highly believed that more confrontations would be witnessed in days to come in the country's political arena. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The United States has entered its last week before the midterm legislative vote, and tensions are starting to escalate. The Republicans appear certain to win the lower House of Representatives and need to win only one of four now neck-and-neck races to also control the upper Senate. Some Democrats have called the polls Republican propaganda, further undermining confidence in their predictions and creating more uncertainty.
I think it should just be positive. It's very hard to decide what is the truth and what isn't. You get the one candidate, and then the next candidate says everything that the first candidate said is wrong on the commercial. We've started muting them.
Perhaps the most telling poll is one which showed that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the country is out of control. Many say there's no lack of reasons for such a perception. The specter of a divided and thus ineffective federal government, record inflation, a prolonged drug epidemic, regular mass shootings, a likely double-dip recession, fear-mongering about war with Russia over Ukraine or with China over Taiwan, a cultural war over identity politics, and more.
Perception is reality, right? So, when we see the political attacks that have happened on both sides, it kind of gives that impression. I think the media can feed into that at times as well. I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of where we're at, unfortunately.
The recent in-home attack on the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who holds the number three post in the American system, has become embroiled in salacious controversy. Similar to the Hunter Biden laptop affair in the autumn of 2020, the case is dominating the pre-vote headlines and producing partisan allegations of either misinformation or a cover-up. Since 2017, the number of investigated threats against Washington's lawmakers has tripled. Perhaps the biggest problem in the United States hasn't even occurred yet, the near certainty of disputed election results. Some tight Senate races may require runoff votes, meaning the final outcome will likely be controversial for weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The UK government has abandoned plans to create a working definition of Islamophobia in a move which has come under heavy fire from critics. Back in May 2019, the then government headed by Theresa May agreed it would seek to establish an Islamophobia definition to get a firmer grip of this bigotry and division. But following mounting frustration over a lack of progress on the issue, the effort has now been reportedly ditched.
The news is hardly surprising, as May's successor, Boris Johnson, has been faulted many times over for saying Islamophobic things, whilst other Tory ministers have also been accused of being deeply Islamophobic themselves.
Reappointed Communities Secretary Michael Gove has been a long-time critic of so-called political Islam, and condemned attempts to define Islamophobia as a danger for free speech.
Michael Gove, while he was at Policy Exchange, was very much supportive of anything which, as far as he was concerned, outed Islam. He calls it political Islam. But actually, in reality, it's a phobia which these folk have about any kind of Muslim. When you look at and compare it to how they deal with anti-Semitism, and they're absolutely hell-bent on definitions, on laws, on rooting out, on chasing, hunting down, witch-hunting anybody who even sniffs the idea of something to do with Jewry, or even say the J word, or even to raise the issue of Zionism, for instance, or to criticize Israel. As soon as you do these things, as far as these neoconservatives are concerned, you are enemy number one.
Islamophobia is a serious problem across Britain. Muslims being the most frequently targeted group for religious hate crimes in England and Wales. Defining Islamophobia could provide new powers to combat anti-Muslim hate, but with a string of scandals having exposed anti-Muslim bigotry within the ruling party itself, Conservatives just don't seem willing to risk shooting themselves in the foot on the issue. Robert Carter, London.
In a narrow alley in the Itaewon Entertainment District of Seoul, more than 150 people suffocated and died in the crush of a crowd on a Halloween Saturday evening. 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian, the most of any foreign nationals, exchange students in their 20s and 30s. This week, the lives lost in the Itaewon tragedy are being mourned with white chrysanthemums and black ribbons. And as the investigation into what happened begins, tough questions are being asked of the government and of the police about what more could have been done to prevent such a disaster. As video and news of the event has circulated in both mass and social media, frustration at the response of the government and police has swelled.
Our country is not even at war. Whose fault is it for this to happen? Why were they so careless? Where were the police? This tragedy wouldn't have happened if the police had controlled traffic with a little effort. What are you going to do after killing all those young people?
South Korean Prime Minister Han Duck-soo appeared before the foreign press Tuesday. He suggested South Korea was still one of the safest countries in the world and that preparations were inadequate in part because the event was not registered. But he admitted some failures.
The real issue was some deficiencies in our crowd management. That kind of deficiencies in our system should have been corrected long before, but it's a reality that it hasn't been done, and at least we should not pass that away again.
The Itaewon tragedy is South Korea's worst disaster since 2014. When a ferry sank, killing 304 people, most of them students on a field trip. Frank Smith, Seoul.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Home Office is recruiting supermarket staff to make life and death asylum decisions. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Observer gives us more detail. The Home Office is hiring asylum decision makers from customer service and sales positions at McDonald's, Tesco's and Aldi's. As part of a recruitment drive to clear its huge backlog of asylum applications, the Observer can reveal. The new recruits hired through online advertising and high street recruitment agencies have no prior experience or knowledge of the asylum system. Many are placed on rolling temporary contracts, typically for 3 months. Despite being promised comprehensive training, decision makers report being left to fend for themselves after 2 days and having to conduct complex interviews and make life or death decisions. Despite such responsibility, sources claim that staff refer to Lonely Planet guides for potted histories of applicants' home countries, prioritize certain nationalities, and preside over a quantity above quality approach. A whistleblower with nearly 2 decades' experience in asylum decision-making, who is currently training new staff to carry out interviews, told The Observer, "They're getting in far too many inexperienced people with no understanding of the asylum system, and they just don't have the support they need, so they leave. It's a total disaster. They don't know what they're doing." The news comes as a new opinion poll for The Observer reveals that the vast majority of the British public, 73%, believe Britain has not taken back control of its borders since Brexit. According to the latest opinion poll, only 12% believe Britain is in control of its borders, while almost half say Brexit has made Britain's ability to manage its borders worse. The Observer's investigation into asylum decision-makers comes after Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, admitted to Parliament last week that not enough asylum applications are being processed, and said the government had increased the number of processing officials by 80%, with another 500 to be appointed by March. There are currently 1,090 decision-makers working to clear the backlog, which now stands at more than 117,000 cases. The backlog is blamed for the significant numbers of asylum seekers being housed in hotels at a cost of more than £5 million a day, and a severe overcrowding at the Manston Asylum Processing Centre in Kent. Home Office officials recently admitted that of the 28,526 people who crossed the Channel in small boats last year, only 1,141, or just 4% of the total, have been processed. UK Daily News has also covered the same story. The Home Office is hiring asylum officers from customer service and sales positions at McDonald's and Tesco's as part of a recruitment campaign to help it clear its huge backlog of asylum applications. The new recruits hired through online advertising and recruitment agencies have no prior experience or knowledge of the asylum system. Many are given rolling fixed-term contracts typically for 3 months. Despite promised comprehensive training, decision-makers report that after just 2 days, they are left to their own devices, conducting complex interviews and making life-or-death decisions. A new Home Office target to triple the number of decisions made by each case officer to 4 a week from 1.3 a week has led some to cite an intense work environment with increased pressure to meet targets. According to a whistleblower, claims are prioritised by nationality, particularly Syrians, Iraqis and Afghans, rather than by the time a person has spent in the United Kingdom awaiting a decision. "It's not a first-come, first-served basis," she said. "Some nationalities, you see them and say, 'That's a documented Syrian,' that'll be easy." The whistleblower added, "When a journalist has asked about someone's case, it goes into the senior case officer's inbox and we say, This is high quality, so the case can be reviewed more quickly. I also had people sitting there looking up Lonely Planet for a country's canned history because the leadership is not clear enough. Some have a profound awareness of what is happening in the world today, but most staff do not. Many long-time clerks maintained that the quality of the interviews was higher prior to 2012, when asylum decision-makers were downgraded from high executive officer grade to executive officer grade. A Home Office official said, "It's a very high-skilled job, but it hasn't been given the respect that it deserves. Quantity is more important than quality." The whistleblower added that the quality of the interviews needed to be addressed as a priority. You can't just refuse without evidence. If you haven't asked the questions, you have no reason to say no. The number of cases dropped in court speaks volumes about the quality of the interviews. British government data shows more than half of denials are overturned on appeal. Substantive hearings are arguably the most important part of the asylum process. A lengthy interview, typically lasting 4 to 8 hours, with decision makers who then give their reflections on whether someone will be granted residency, refugee status, or denial of protection. Mark Sawatka, the General Secretary of the Public and Commercial Services Union, says, "Our members are doing their best to deal humanely with asylum seekers in a highly politicized environment. It's a very stressful job, made difficult by a lack of training and a lack of investment." Rob McNeil, Deputy Director of the Migration Observatory at Oxford University, says it was one of the toughest jobs in the immigration industry. Rob McNeil says, "Caseworkers are under significant time pressures applying hundreds of pages of instructions to the complex human stories that they encounter. These are life and death decisions that require skill, training and experience. Wrong decisions create personnel costs for applicants and financial costs for the government."
Start. Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
This is Youth Station, Choo Choo Kachoo. It's the Youth Station for you. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio, we have a very special and, might I say, unique guest.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm Vita. The meaning of my name actually means unique, and it was the thing that Brother Muzaffar was mentioning. Actually, I'm really happy to have the pleasure to be here with you.
So we're talking about youth, because this is the Youth Station, choo-choo-ka-choo,
yeah.
It's the Youth Station for you, that's right. And youth, would you consider me as a youth sister?
No, of course not.
How dare you? How could you be so
only
cruel?
Teen numbers can be, you know, mentioned as youth.
No, what are you talking about? Teen?
Talking about
that,
me.
That means you only have 2 more years of being a youth.
It was dark. So no, I changed my opinion. You are youth at the age of 30.
How
older?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm over the age of 30. But so Islamically, by the way, Islamically, you're a youth until 40.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Kind of. Yeah. You know how they say in the West, life begins at 40?
No.
It's actually a reality. Well, they say that. Okay.
Okay.
There's a reality behind it. Okay. But since I'm the older one here, I would like to bring out my old man side and complain about the youth. I mean, what's wrong with the youth nowadays? They're just out of control, man.
Come on, it's the same old story that I don't want to talk about, actually, but I'm going to tell you that this is not a problem of youth generation. This is a problem of you.
That's what I'm talking about. The youth always seem to have to blame somebody else. So your generation, right? Your generation is like Generation Z, right? They always have to blame the generations before them for every problem that exists. And I guess there's a reality behind it, but this is what I'm talking. You guys are out of control, man. In my day, we used to have some sense of self-responsibility. That's what it is.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, I'm gonna actually tell you something that was really interesting for myself. I was reading something about the old Egypt, and there was a comment on one stone that was telling that okay, in that age, the youth generation is so rebellious. For 1,000 years ago, they were telling okay, at the past we were better, but the youth generation right now is out of control. Uh-huh. 1,000 years ago, they were telling that, and at this time again, you are telling me the same thing. So it means that this is not the problem of youth generation at this time. This is the problem of conflict between young generation and the older generation. You know, and this conflict I think comes from the generation gap. You know, we have different thoughts.
So you're saying that every older generation has always thought the same things about the younger generation and vice versa?
Generally, yes. And exceptions don't break the rules.
You might be right, because I remember watching cartoons when I was a kid, and in those cartoons, they would have old men saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, back in my day.
I think there is two things. First of all, you're younger than me, and if I had the time that you have, I would do that. I would do this. I wouldn't do that. And this is a sense of I wanted to be like you, and this feeling will share itself as blaming the youth generation. I think
that's the first time I've heard that, but there might be some reality behind that. Actually,
it is.
And
there is another perspective, I think. And this is that they think we are alike. We are different persons, okay? We are individuals. And they just don't want to accept this. They think age really matters. But actually, it doesn't matter, I think. You can be 18 years old, but actually, intellectually, you are 40 or something.
We're going to come back to this idea after a short break, inshallah. We'll see you very soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Well, there's one thing that I have noticed, because my generation is what they refer to as the millennials, right? So the generation before us, so my father's generation, I've noticed that that generation had more respect for the elders than my generation and subsequent generations.
To some extent, I have to agree with that one.
Mm.
You know, my generation is like, okay, I know everything because I want to tell
that's
you
what
the
I'm
roots
talking about.
Of this.
Out of control, totally out of control. Whereas that generation used to be like, they used to have a sense of humbleness that, we have to obey our elders.
I agree with that, right?
Okay, so
I think there is a reason behind that, and this reason is technology. I'm going to go through that. Because technology is serving us with many different opportunities. Today, the speed of doing anything and going through any relation is so high that we cannot tolerate anything else in real world. You know, for example, when you go through social media, you can connect to other people around the world without going out of your home. You know, and this facility makes you want more.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? And I think this is the problem that we have in our youth generation, because they have more, they want more.
Mm-hmm.
And this makes them somehow disrespectful against their parents and their older generation.
It's very sad. And it is a lot about that instant gratification that we're all getting. You know, you click, you get everything. You click, 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 yeah. click. Whatever you want, you just click it. We order our groceries online as well nowadays. But anyway, there's a hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam and of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, where they say that venerating the old is very important. Mm-hmm. And what they say is venerating the elderly among the Muslim community is like venerating Allah. And another hadith says that one who has not venerated or given respect and that kind of honor yeah. to the elderly from among the Muslims has not venerated me, i.e. the Holy Prophet himself. So this idea of showing respect to the elderly is actually a part of Islam.
Yeah.
But I feel like we've let go of a lot of that.
No, I don't think so. Actually, I'm going to tell you that as we have many hadith and quotations or something that are telling us to respect our elders, there should be a respect, okay? You have to consider the youth thoughts because they are the young generation and they are new. They have more to show you and they have more abilities and you have to trust them sometimes. And this trust, I think, is lost. We should have.
Nice
know, there
try,
should be There should be a respect which is two-sided. You know?
Well, I'll tell you this. We do have a hadith that says this, that you should respect the elderly because they've done more a'mal, and you should respect the young because they've committed less sins. Right?
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. So, yeah, there is this mutual respect that also needs to be there. And I feel like it is a problem if the youth are unduly disrespected and treated like they're not a part of the society. There is that problem as well. But at the same time, I gotta say, the youths nowadays are just out of control.
Come on, what do you mean by out of control? What should we do to convince you that we are not out of control?
You're not out of control. You're a good girl. You're a medical student. I'm not talking about you. Don't worry.
Being a medical student doesn't mean that you're a good girl, but okay.
Don't take it personally. No, I mean, I'll give you an example. Okay. So my uncle, he used to say that, you know, we used to work really, really hard to even get a small blessing in life, you know, for example, to acquire a job or to, pass an interview or an important exam or to get a driver's license and all those kinds of things. It used to take a long time. And if we did it, it was a big deal. Whereas this generation, they kind of take such things for granted.
I know what you mean. I think the root problem is that you are telling me that the conditions were the same. No, the conditions aren't the same. You know, for example, we have many difficulties too in our society that we have to struggle with. Many problems that you didn't have at your generation.
Like?
You know, for example, because of the social media and perfectionism or something like that, when we go through the real world, it's like we lost our self-confidence and we have some kind of mental problems to interact with other people. But you didn't have that problem because there were no technology to communicate that
much. Wait, sorry. What was the problem? Mental problems?
No, not that much mental. I mean, social problems to communicate and interact with other people.
But then, look, that generation would argue, well, that's your own fault. We kept telling you not to engage so much in social media and so much in video
games.
Social
media is everywhere, you know. We can limit ourselves, but we cannot limit the world.
Yeah, I suppose so. And you need to kind of keep up, otherwise you can't really survive in this brave new world. And when you try to keep up with it, you end up becoming a part of it.
Yeah, exactly. So this is not only our problems that we are out of control. We have to be out of control to survive in even our generation.
One of the things that I feel that applies not only to the Generation Z and millennials, but also even to the boomer generation, even the generation before us, just perhaps to a lesser extent, is this idea of not being thankful for blessings. We really, honestly, the world that we live in, everything is kind of just given to us. Yeah, we have to work. I'm not saying we don't have to work hard. We don't have to put in energy and effort. Like, I'll give you a very small example. Hot water. Have you ever noticed that? We just take we have hot water. It's just normal for us to have hot water, you know, or, you know, the kettle. You know, you just click the button and you've got hot water now.
So it is a problem that...
These are all great. These are all blessings, right? Washing machine. You know, it's all this convenience. The refrigerator. If you go back... I remember the other day somebody gave me some fruits. A good friend of mine, he brought some fruits and I did not appreciate it at all. I was like, oh, I don't want those. I could have gotten them myself, you know. But I was thinking about a past generation. I mean, like let's go back 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have hot water. They had to wash their clothes by hand. They had to do all of these basic things. They didn't have refrigerators. They had to go out and get food and bring that back to the house. And when they had anything, and if anybody brought them a bowl of fruits, it would be like the most extraordinary thing. And they would be very, very happy and thankful for it.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
We've been given so much convenience that I feel we've almost lost touch with what it means to be a human.
Mm-hmm. I know what you mean. You're telling me that because nowadays the way towards the blessings are so much easier and we can just receive them so much easier than the past time. We are not that much thankful. And because of this lack of thankfulness in our behavior, we act as some rebellious creatures that are going to go through some other ways or something. But, you know, I'm going to tell you that I do agree. I cannot tell anything else because actually there exists something like that in our generation. They have a lot of time because they don't have any kind of work to do. They have a lot of time to reflect on other things that are somehow destructive. You know what? They are thinking about some philosophical matters that are somehow at the higher level than their intellectual power. And they cannot handle that. And even at the same time, they think that they are philosophers. They think that they are knowledgeable about anything. And they don't want to accept that the truth that, okay, they lack experience. And I think this experience...
You're talking about the youth?
Yeah, I'm talking about the youth generation. And I think this lack of experience can make a bond between these two generations. You have experience, and I'm going to go through this experience of yours, not to experience it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this connection, this bond should be more stronger.
Hadith of Imam Ali off the back of that, he said that, alayhi salam, he said that I know history so well, it is as if I lived it. And off what you were saying, he said something along the lines of how he actually learned from the experiences of others rather than having to commit those mistakes himself.
Yeah.
And that there's a great deal of wisdom behind that. From myself and from Sister Beta, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.